I think if you look at how the website was set up, it built for news, opinion, and commentary. A lot of personal writing. I don't want to say it is a blog, but it did grow up in that blog era. And I think that that blog ethos is the backbone of Kotaku. It wasn't even just that they were asking for guides. They were asking for something like 50 guide posts a week, which yeah. Like for seven people, that's a lot. That's an impossible amount.
Whether you love Kotaku or you hate Kotaku, it's the personality of the website that gets you coming to it anyway. Just look at Alyssa. Look at Alyssa on Twitter right now. She's popping off. That's kind of how we handle it. Kind of laughing because it's so pathetic. Like, truly. To be this upset and this internet-pilled. It sounds so cliche, but please, go touch grass. I think I remember getting a DM very recently of someone saying that to me, that they knew where I work. They just said, I know where you work. And I was like, wait, everyone knows where I work, but what do you mean here? You know, my grandma always raised me to do unto others as you've done unto them. And I say that because that's how I try to treat people. You know, unless someone's a known misogynist, a known offender, a known bigot, you know, a J.K. Rowling, or there's enough credible evidence for me to do my research that allows me to know verifiably that that person's bad, or if I have enough friends who tell me that you shouldn't, you know, interact with that person, then it's okay, a subset of gamers hate black people. And I don't think that that's wrong to say.
Hello and welcome to Culturescape, the show that interviews the geek creators and influencers who built nerd culture. I'm your host, Pete Pischke, and today we will explore games journalism, from its intricacies to the ongoing Gamergate 2.0 discourse, and more specifically, the website Kotaku. Today I'm happy to have with us our guest is Levi Winslow, a seasoned games reporter and Kotaku staff writer with over a decade of experience in games journalism, and over a whopping 3,000 entries on MuckRack, which is that has a heck of a lot of articles. Wow. Welcome to the show, Levi. It's great to have you.
Hi, Peter. Yes, thank you. 3,000 articles. That's a lot. I didn't even realize.
Yeah, some of it's double dip. MuckRack does that. So if your article, if it shows up at your site, but then it pops up on Yahoo, they'll double dip you. But still, it's a lot. It's a lot of entries.
I mean, I guess it makes sense when you've been doing this for, I can't believe it. Yeah, it's 9-10 years.
I think I got started off and on working in journalism in 2015, and sometimes it's down. It really is crazy, the workflow, how much you get through it, and then you look back, you're like, oh, wow, I wrote a lot of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. There are days where I'll write something, and by the end of the day, I'll completely have forgotten the thing that I wrote earlier in the morning, or weeks where it's forgot what I wrote on Tuesday, but that Tuesday post ended up being one of the big posts of the day or something. Just so much, you know, you're doing so much work in this field. It's very easy to have it all blur together to where you mix days up or mix posts up or sometimes even mix sites up.
Oh, no, I've had that experience too where you have to think back, did I write about that?
Yeah.
Did I? I don't remember.
Exactly.
Okay, so of course the framing for a lot of this stuff, I'll just give a little bit for people who aren't paying attention to all this. Kotaku recently faced controversy about a week and a half ago when editor-in-chief Jen Glennon departed after just 6 months. This happened in response to GEO Media CEO Jim Spanfeller's decision to shift from news to guides, and we'll get into that in a bit, which sparked heated debates online. So today I'm hoping we can discuss this, the challenges of games journalism, where demanding work often meets a relatively little compensation, which I don't think a lot of people know. We will get into the issues of bias and trying to balance clicks with good journalism, and what's it really like to be a games journalist? You know, with Google throttling traffic and ad rates hitting rock bottom, the survival of sites like Kotaku, but journalism in general right now hangs in the balance, which is, it's so crazy out there. And people have no idea if they don't work in the industry. They just do not know, but it's really meager at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. I was out with some friends very recently and I was talking to them, you know, they're not in media. So I was talking to them about a little bit of the struggles that I was going through at Go Media, some of the other things that have happened, you know, Pitchfork being folded into GQ, Vice.com going down, things like that. And my friend was like, what? I was like, yeah, these are like really big things. She was like, I didn't even know about Vice. Like, that's crazy. I'm like, maybe if you're very online, or if you are like a news junkie and you just like to read a lot, maybe you'd be in the know. But I imagine for, like you said, normies, normal people, they don't know how dire it is to be a journalist. And that's not to say that it's like the hardest job ever. I mean, there are millions of harder jobs than what I do. But that doesn't mean that it isn't hard in its own way.
Definitely true. I always get in trouble because I've worked in the news some. I've been a journalist. I always feel like I kind of want to defend people, even when I disagree with them, because it's like, it's not it isn't like physically demanding in the same way like blue collar work is, but it can take a real toll on you. And you know, the wage rates, your average journalist, if they're doing okay, maybe they're in the 60K region, like a reporter at their very top, maybe they're pulling in 100K, and that's pretty rare. In many ways,
totally.
It's really a working class job, which always makes so many people online mad, but that's just the truth of it, guys. Sorry.
It really is. I mean, we are working out here. We're hustling. How else do you think people are putting up, you know, multiple stories? How else do you think I've written 3,000 articles?
No, it's a lot of work, and it you're always on. You're like, you're working when you're not working. It's kind of YouTube, I guess, being an influencer is like that, because like you're constantly thinking, okay, what's my next project, or how am I going to balance? Like, I love doing game reviews, and I've been doing this a little bit more on the side right now, but it messes with your head, because working and playing games is different than when you're just playing a game and you're just, you know, enjoying it and relax.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's definitely part of the issue is once you enter into this field. And I guess you can say that about anything that you turn from a passion into a job. All of that love that you have for the thing that normally you would just do as like a hobby, or a thing that you would do on the side, a thing that you would do in your free time or when you want to wind down. Once that becomes your job and you're constantly thinking about that, it becomes almost soul crushing. That's kind of like part of the working class element of it, I think, is just the idea of passion being monetized, and then ultimately through being dehumanized through capitalism. So yeah, like it's this, okay, you know, I'm playing Rise of the Ronin, right? I haven't even beat the game yet. 57 hours into the game. I'm on like the middle of chapter 3, haven't beaten the game. Review did, and I think that it's great, but then Dragon's Dogma comes out, and so, you know, you have to do some sort of coverage around what might be the biggest RPG ever, so, or not ever, but of 2024. So I'm sitting here, and I'm playing Rise of the Ronin, but I'm also thinking about Dragon's Dogma, and researching Dragon's Dogma, and have Dragon's Dogma pitches in the background, but at the same time, I'm also checking Rise of the Ronin trends on Google to see what people are searching, to figure out if there's something that I can do there. So it's like it's a rat race. Your brain's always on, like you said. It's a light that never dies.
Yeah, and it's funny because you can, when like getting back into writing about games some more, it's like you feel like you never really get to sit with a game as long as you want, because you're like, I have to get to the next big thing, and then
totally
and you're like, no, now I have to get to the next big thing, and it's like four next big things later in the first game, I'm like, I really want to get back into that, but I don't think I will.
Yeah, you're like, oh, I'm so tired.
So let's talk about a little bit about what's going on with Kotaku. Kotaku, of course, is one of the bigger, it's one of the bigger, smaller games websites. I mean, it's not like IGN size, but it as
of course.
As a dedicated to games site, it actually does pretty well, especially put against like its contemporaries, like, I don't know, like Polygon or Destructoid. The recent heat, of course, was everything going on with the CEO, Jim Spanfeller. That's such an interesting name. Jim Spanfeller, and he was... Can you tell us a little bit about this? Because from what I was told from the Chuds online, it was just that, oh, he thinks that you guys should just be covering guides, and, like, that's so easy. Why aren't you guys doing that? You know, you're a bunch of whiny crybabies. Why would you write the games guides, huh?
Well, I mean... And, you know, I have to, of course, choose my words carefully here, but you basically summed it up. It came from this desire to compare us to other games websites and wondering why
we weren't getting that same sort of traffic without realizing, or maybe in spite of realizing, that those other sites have larger staffs that are dedicated to those things. Whereas we, you know, we are a big site, but I think you're right. I think we're a little more, not mid-tier, but just above that, right? We're not the IGN, the GameSpot, but we are closer to the Eurogamer, the Polygon. So when you're trying to, when you're trying to achieve something that is only achievable if you had double, maybe even triple the staff, that creates this pressure, this stressing of the system, as has been sort of passed around online through the company. It's exactly that. It's stressing of the system. It's, you know, we're trying to increase our numbers, we're trying to increase our audience, we're trying to grow. And so how do we grow? Well, you know, it looks like guides are an SEO-friendly way to create this evergreen road, or this evergreen ramp, for gamers to then find their way into Kotaku, into the Kotaku ecosystem. So it's this, like, door into Kotaku, but then it's also this sort of net to catch traffic. That's basically what it comes down to, is like, we're doing good, let's see if we can do better, let's grow, let's focus on guides. That should be doing it.
Without thinking, though, this is part of the statement that your former EIC made. In fact, I think I have it just over here. She says, "I firmly believe the decision to invert Kotaku's editorial strategy to deprioritize news in favor of guides is fundamentally misguided given the current infrastructure of the site. The decision is directly contradicted by months of traffic data and shows an astonishing disregard for the livelihoods of the remaining writers and editors who work here." I think, I can't remember if it was you or not, but someone was saying that it wasn't even just that they were asking for guides. They were asking for something like 50 guide posts a week, which is like for seven people. And I think that's how many people work at Kotaku. That's a lot. That's like an impossible amount.
In total, you have 10 people at Kotaku, two of which are editors, a video person, everyone else is writers. So yeah, 50 guides a week, that totals to about a guide and a half a day. And, you know, when you're funneling that to two editors, and guides are sometimes very long, they're not a quick 300-400 word news post, they're 600-800, sometimes even 1,000, depending on the guide, word sort of treaties, if you will. So they're difficult to edit too. So that creates this bottleneck where, you know, it's a lot of overworking to try to get these insurmountable aspirations that the company may have. It makes it very difficult. So I'm not, you know, I agree with what the former EIC said. She's totally right. I think, you know, without getting into the specifics of numbers and traffic, I think even if you just look at the way that Kotaku is set up as a website, if you look at the web, you know, pre the total shift in the homepage, because it looks very different now if you go to it than what it was just at the start of the year. I think if you look at how the website was set up, it's built for news, opinion, and commentary. A lot of personal writing. I don't want to say it is a blog, but it did grow up in that blog era. And I think that that blog ethos is the backbone of Kotaku. So trying to shift that, right, trying to put it in a back brace so that the spine lays in a different way, well, it's going to create some muscle tension.
It does, and I don't think business people necessarily understand. Audiences aren't going to just go with anything. Like, they have a relationship with you for a specific reason, and the farther you move from that, you know, there's a greater likelihood you lose the readership. You know, sometimes it works, but often it there are many, many such cases where large shifts an editorial policy, like, the audience is like, okay, I'm out. I wasn't here for that. No, thank you.
Very alienating, totally. And I hate to say it, but our, you know, the readers catch on. I read the comments very often, And so I know what these, I know what they think. I know how they're feeling about these changes. Even on the sites that don't have comments right now, there are a couple that still do. And the ones that do, again, the readers, they know. They know what's up and they have questions. And it's weird for us, you know, as personalities of these websites. I mean, that's what I think, whether you love Kotaku or you hate Kotaku, it's the personality of the website that gets you coming to it anyway. You know, when you're sort of sanding down that personality, people are going to be like, well, what's going on? You know, what happened to X? Why can't we comment on Y? Yeah, people know. I don't think anyone's dumb.
Yeah, that's right. And it is a huge mistake when either writers or business people assume their readership is dumb. That rarely leads to good consequences. If it's okay, I'd like Kotaku, of course. I've been, by the way, I like the site. I mean, I disagree with it almost as often as I agree with it, but it's a very engaging site. I've been reading it since, I mean, goodness gracious, probably 2012 when I was in J school.
Well, thank you.
And I especially loved the phase when you guys had like the Kotaku East people. I was kind of sad to see some of that go, but yeah, I think it's interesting. You guys are engaging. You're engaging. Like, even if I don't like it, I know I'm just going to leave me somewhat entertained or interested. So you can't see that.
And that's ultimately our point, right? Is, you know, before you get on to the next thing, I just want to really say that that's really the point of Kotaku, is to be entertaining. We, you know, every writer is different. We're not a monolith. We don't all agree on the same thing that goes up on the website. We think it's written well, but that doesn't mean that it's like our viewpoint, like as an individual person. So, you know, whether the headline is what you disagree with or the arguments in the post itself, hopefully you walk away with feeling like that was thought-provoking. You know, that got me thinking.
Yeah, no, and there is value to that because not everyone can do that. Ability to create attention, hold attention, is a talent. I think Kotaku's problem, it's the double-edged sword, and I think Gawker kind of set you guys up, which of course was kind of the original mothership going way
back. That's mother.
Yeah, and Kotaku was of that era where it was like getting a high amount of content and then leading into like outrage content, right? So it's like getting all those clicks, getting people really excited, energetic. They want to engage either to push it down or support it. And it's great if it does both. That was one of Kotaku's strengths. But that's also like now one of Kotaku's great weaknesses, because it's and I think this is going to be sound strange, because I know some it sounds like Lissa Mercanti, who's one of your coworkers, is a huge fan of his. But Aspen Gold made this really great point the other day. He did a 25-minute video of him, not commentary, just him talking about games journalism. And he made this point that one of the problems that games journalism has, it's because he said, I'm not going to use the language he did, because he can get away saying things on YouTube I can't. But
oh, YouTube.
Yeah, he said it's basically like you could build 100 bridges, and if you burn someone one time, it's that one time that anyone will remember. And if you look at Kotaku's content, it's probably 25% or less easily are the outrage stuff. Like most of the time, your comment is commentary on the news, or you're talking about breaking news, or you're breaking the news yourself, or it's, oh, here's this one person doing this funny thing we saw on Instagram or TikTok. But that's not what sticks in people's minds. It's the, you know, the Gamers Are Dead articles from 2014, or the old PS5 review, or I don't know, I could go on for ages, or like I'm sure my audience is well familiar with many of the controversies over there. And it's like, for all the good work that you guys do and all the bridge building, it's like all the outrage stuff, which used to be so positive and helpful for the site, it almost feels like that's a anchor that's weighing you guys down. But this isn't a problem unique to Kotaku. This is a problem that's not unique, to almost like every site that isn't specifically hard news. Like they're all kind of feeling this.
Yeah. See, I think that's.
Sorry, that was a lot, by the way.
No, it's all good. And I totally understand exactly what you mean, because there are posts that I've read, you know, even before I started working here in September 2021, there are posts that I've read where it was like, I don't know if I'd say that. Or there's headlines that I've, you know, raised my eyebrow at and wondered how that went. There are arguments that are made in posts that I'm like, I don't think that that's totally true. But I think when it comes to things that you disagree with, if you just remember that it's that person's opinion, and not that like you can't argue or debate it, but just remember that it's their opinion and not the news. Hopefully that would help separate the two, because at least I know in my work, when it comes to like me writing a news piece, like Microsoft laying off 1,900 people, that's just news. You know, I'm not trying to flavor that in any way. I'm not putting any spin or anything like that. But if I'm writing something about how the, like a post that I wanted to write was, I reviewed Wolong Fallen Dynasty. I thought that that was a great game, but the jump in it sucks. It's a terrible jump. And I really had some strong opinions about it when the game came out and it was trafficking well. So I thought that I would write that. Ended up didn't. But not that that opinion would like break the social fabric of gamer identity or anything like that. I just think when it comes to having these strong opinions on the news, it's helpful to remember that those are just that person's opinion. Now, of course, there are things that happen where maybe a post wasn't as thorough as it should have, right? To that, I just say, I don't know, girl, we're human. You know, we definitely try. I know that I try to do the best work that I can. Try to keep it as focused and as thorough and as fact-checked as I can. And if I ever am called out in the comments, well, then I respond to that and I update the article accordingly. You know, we're just trying to do due diligence at the end of the day.
I wonder sometimes with some of this if there's a media literacy problem, because I think people used to have more of an understanding about the division between what was news and what was opinion. And maybe some of that is the internet's fault. Like they made it messy. But it just feels like to me like people are looking at, whether it's news content or even YouTube content, it's all just kind of falling into the same basket now.
Yeah.
Which is kind of unfair, because the dynamics of working in news, and it's hard for you to understand unless you've worked it, is very different from being a YouTuber and influencer. Like, I'll give you an example. If you did this review about, you said Rise of Ronin. I keep getting the name wrong. Rise of Ronin by Team Ninja, which sounds awesome. It happens during the Bakumitsu period. I'm sure I got that wrong, which is a fascinating part of that's the modernizing of Japan. So I'm really interested in trying that out. If they said, Levi, we like your review. We like some of your coverage. So we're going to send you some Japanese swords. And if you happen to, you want to keep writing really positive things about us, that'd be great. Now, if what should happen, that situation, of course, is your editor be like, I'm sorry, you don't get to keep the swords. We're donating them. However, if you are a YouTuber, you can go to that YouTuber directly. You can pay them. I mean, there have been several cases. I think Angry Joe was one of them, where they were complaining about, well, you want me to cover your game. You know, you should give me some payola. I mean, that's not how he phrased it, obviously.
Close enough.
Yeah, or you see all these influencers, and they're like, oh, I was feeling jealous about Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, but I got to go to the Final Fantasy Rebirth set and look at this cool merch I got. And like all of that is like so frowned upon in like journalism, but it's totally okay in influencer and YouTube land, just for an example.
I definitely agree that there's a blurring between what is a journalist and what is an influencer or a YouTuber. And not that like a YouTuber can't, or a journalist can't be a YouTuber. I just don't necessarily think that YouTubers are always journalists. There's a different sort of skill set that goes into these two creative paths. They overlap a lot, but I think the end product looks very different, and what goes on behind the scenes is also very different. So, you know, yeah, there's an issue with media literacy. You know, at the same time, I'm not going to say that, like, we as reporters aren't wrong either. there are some times where headlines will get workshopped into something that doesn't always match the vibe or the nature of the post itself. And, you know, to that, I always say, remember that it's usually editors who make the final call on the headlines. It's not the writer. Not that anyone needs to then go hunt down the site's editors and like send them death threats or anything, but just remember that there's always a hierarchy in this American society, just in this world that we live in, and that what you read on the page isn't always always the final decision of the person's byline that's attached to that. So, you know, it's a sort of both ways issue. I think we as reporters could definitely be doing better in terms of having more straightforward headlines with more sort of clear, less maybe flavored or less spiced sentences and writing in the news so that it's just straight. But then also readers could remember that, you know, when something is a little spicy, that it's an opinion and that we can argue opinions, but we're not going to, you know, argue with anger and start sending death threats and harassing the person and trying to dox them and all that insane shit.
I want to get into, if you're comfortable with that, because I'm curious what that experience is for you and your compatriots at the website. And like, what's the policy or how do you deal with it? Because that is that's the problem with being prolific online, especially when it comes to something like games or entertainment. It does seem to be a lightning rod for bad behavior online. So do you experience a lot of that, or like, what do you guys do to handle it? Because I have to imagine with the current discourse that some of that would at least be an issue for you.
Yeah. Well, I guess to answer how do we handle it, you know, just look at Alyssa. Look at Alyssa on Twitter right now. She's popping off. That's kind of how we handle it. I'm not like that. I don't tend to do well in responses because I'm just not like witty and, you know, like spicy like that. Like, I'm not pithy like that. So I don't have like quick comebacks or anything. I tend to write long. So that makes it very difficult for me to reply because character limit. So for me, like when I end up getting harassed, depending on the level of the harassment, I will either lock my account or honestly, I'll just log off. And just like, because I don't have the app on my phone, I really only check it when I'm at work. I'll occasionally scroll when I'm off, but that's like through the browser. So for me, unless it's like really, really bad, like not this last time, but I think in 2022, maybe 2023, when Andrew Tate first got arrested, mm-hmm. I had said, you know, self-professed internet misogynist Andrew Tate, and I got so much hate for just that little like 4 or 5 words in this 400-word post. And you know, people were DMing me on Instagram. They found my Instagram. They were sending me emails talking about how dare you disrespect the top G. You've disgraced your heritage. You've disgraced your family. You've disgraced name. I was like, what? People were like, you know, that's why the top G is going to get out of prison, and I hope that you, you know, keep yourself safe. I was like, this is insane. This is insane. All because I said self-professed internet misogynist. They're like, where did he say that? I had to clip him saying that just so that they like saw that he said that. But even when I did that, people were still mad. So I don't know, you know, I continue to see it with this whole Sweet Baby Ink discourse and now Black Girl Gamers, which it's exhausting, but at the same time, I'm just kind of laughing because it's so pathetic, like truly, to be this upset and this internet pilled to where you're gonna like harass people you literally don't know. And by the time you die, won't even remember. It's just, I don't know.
it sounds so cliche, but like, please go touch grass. Go to a museum. There are some beautiful art pieces you could be looking at.
Making sure that your Twitter consumption is on the desktop browser and keeping notifications off, very wise. That's a very good, that's a very good health tip. I highly recommend that.
Absolutely. Dodges all the Menchies that you don't want.
I've always been curious because I kind of always felt like news wanted their, not necessarily the editor, well, somewhat the editors, but news, these companies wanted their writers to court the dragon, right? To get that outrage, get that attention, get that heat. But then they never had really an answer. Okay, so what do you do though when like a crazy person, like they become overly interesting? Now there are plenty of stories. I had Taylor Renz on last month, and she, you know, some stuff we talked about, some stuff she showed me after the show that she felt wasn't, if we talked about, would be insecure for her. Like, it's a real problem for certain people. And it never feels like corporate media really ever has a good answer for it, except like, don't be online, which is enough. You know, often that is enough, but sometimes it's not. So I am curious on that.
Sometimes it's not. And, you know, as Taylor Renz has probably talked about, Libs of TikTok has been cited as sort of influence for sending bomb threats to, you know, various schools. Maybe that'll get cut, but I'm just using that as an example of like what can happen when this online bullying turns into real world harassment. So yeah, it's very strange that when you have literal examples like that, corporations, CEOs, you know, people at the top are just like, oh, I didn't know. Why don't you just like close your laptop? And it's like, yeah, I could, and I do, because I have to log off as well. But even when I do, like, I don't know, what if someone knows my address? Like, what if someone knows the bars that I like, or, you know, has figured out where I work or something? I think I remember getting a DM very recently of someone saying that to me, that they knew where I work. I think it was actually public on Twitter. They just said, like, I know where you work. And I was like, wait, like, everyone knows where I work, but like, what do you mean here? Because like, it's very different when you say, I know where you work. So it's questionable to me that harassment is allowed to sort of proliferate online, both in face of Elon Musk, who literally won't do anything about it, and in the face of CEOs and other sort of corpo top dogs who, again, like Musk, won't do anything about it. So it's up to us. It's up to us as, you know, the writers to develop strategies that are to develop healthy strategies that will alleviate the stress that comes from this sort of harassment. But really, it's also up to the readers to just like, I don't know, relax, like chill out. It's not that serious. It's video games. Like at the end of the day, this is just video games. Like no one's dying over, well, shouldn't say that, but really no one's dying.
Generally,
over video
usually,
games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To push back a little bit, not on the harassment, but I mean, certain people definitely in games journalism, I don't know why, maybe it's because it's, I don't know, maybe there's something different about games journalism, but you do get people who are more antagonistic, I would say unnecessarily so. I'm not putting that on you, I don't want to put any pressure on you about that, but it feels like maybe some of that is just proactive defense. It's like the block list. It's like, we're going to put this block list, it's going to block a lot of people who definitely are a problem, but it also grabs a lot of people who are not. Like generally I've usually been pretty polite with people online, but you know, I think I'm blocked by like half the people who go tag them, at least. And it feels like, you know, putting aside necessarily like political cultural biases or anything, it does feel like sometimes that isn't always handled the best. And I don't want to put you in a bad position, because that's like, these are the people you work with and you do behave yourself pretty well online. I know most people who work in media do. But it's like you always get those few bad actors that seem to like put a bad light on everyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, I view myself more as like a wallflower, a lurker. I scroll a lot, so I tend to,
you know, I'll occasionally comment, I'll tweet here and there, but I'm more often just kind of like reading things to see if anything sparks inspo or if I can find a post in the morning. And I'll see, you know, my peers replying, quote retweeting, and I'm just like, I wouldn't do that. You know, like, you're like willingly pushing them to the front of the stage, which ultimately to humiliate them, but in some respect, give them infamy and some form of notoriety, whether that's within their friend circle or their Discord server or whatever it may be. There's this, both parties are benefiting from this in some way. And so I just find that dynamic kind of strange for me.
Yeah, me too.
You know, my grandma always raised me to do unto others as you've done unto them. And I say that because that's how I try to treat people. Like, if I know nothing about you, then I'm not going to assume the worst about you. And so I hope that you would, you know, do the same unto me. And so if I give you respect, I hope that you would give me respect. But the moment you mess up, that's when it's like, okay, now you've, you know, sort of betrayed my trust, then I don't have to be respectful anymore. Like, I don't have to make space for you because I've given you that space, that respect, and you've broken it. So that's just how I try to treat people. You know, unless someone's like a known misogynist, a known offender, a known bigot, you know, a J.K. Rowling, like, or there's enough credible evidence for me to do my research that allows me to know verifiably that that person's bad, or if I have enough friends who tell me that you shouldn't, you know, interact with that person, then it's like, okay, I'm gonna listen to this because there's enough evidence pointing to this person being a bad person. But if I don't know that you're a bad person, I'm not just gonna think you're a bad person. And so I'm not just gonna like come after you for no reason. But again, that's just how I behave, like online and offline. So I know that there are some people in media who sort of maybe thrive or really enjoy in sort of like a sadistic kind of way, like publicly whipping smaller accounts or whatever have you, like idiots online, which, hey, I'm laughing right there with the crowd, but that's not my character. And that's not to like, you know, down talk anyone, because if that's what they need, if that's like their healthy release to this, if that's how they respond, if that's how they rebel against what ultimately is harassment and bullying, then by all means, like, I'm gonna let them do that. But I'm gonna let them do that, you know, like, I'm not going to fall into that.
I agree. Mostly. I agree. I think at this point, it's like the Streisand effect. It's like if Chris Kindred, Sweet Baby Games, if he had never got concerned about the Steam page, then the gamers and the writer or whatever, they would have never got excited about defaming this guy. And no one would ever know the name, the Twitter user Cabrutus. Like, it would be just a complete nothing burger to everyone. But since it gave attention, that of course then, you know, everyone starts getting engaged. And that's the thing about being in media, it's like by the same hand that you get that you get all this fire, it's also the same way, you know, you build your own up. But I don't know, this is a big problem. It's not just Kotaku. This is something I learned, you know, the little time I did in conservative news journalism, just a little bit on the side. I mean, it's everywhere. It is a big problem. There's not really a good solution to it, because it's like either you play in the system and you go along, or you don't, and I guess you just don't get to be part of media, which is why I appreciate people like you, and I'm trying to be more like this, where you're like, you know, I'm just going to try to model good behavior. I'm just going to try to be normal and hope that's enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, this is like what I wanted to do. You know, all I've ever wanted to do with my life is write, and I hope that I'm just producing good writing that's informative, entertaining, funny, relatable in some sort of way. And that's all that I can do. You know, I will say, to push back against the Sweet Baby Ink stuff, there's power in calling out bigotry. And what was going down in that server was totally, you know, blatant racism. There was a lot of hateful stuff happening in that server that definitely needed to be called out. So I'm glad that there's a discourse happening. Well, I don't want to say a discourse, but I'm glad that that was brought to light. However, I think that the engagement then around it, I think this is the problem with social media, this sort of engagement farming, where now we're dunking on each other for style points or something, I think is losing the message. You know, we're forgetting the plot. I think it's all distractions from the point that was initially made, in which a subset of gamers hate Black people. And I don't think that that's wrong to say. I find it disappointing. I think it's also helpful to remember that it is a subset of gamers. Because do we have numbers? I haven't seen any. Maybe I haven't been reading any studies, or maybe I haven't been reading enough, but I certainly don't know of, like, you know, all the gamer friends that I have, like, they haven't told me that they hate Black people. So I don't know. But from my engagements online, from the conversations that I've seen happen online, I can definitely say that there is a subset of gamers that hate Black folks. And that is a problem. Now, again, all that engagement after that, the name calling, the you know, I'm better than you, my account is better than yours, no, I'm smarter than you, all of that on top of that, a little unnecessary.
I will admit I have not thoroughly vetted the original Cabrutus Sweet Baby Ink Steam page. I just don't. Like, it is interesting to know, like, from a newsy perspective, just, like, I'm okay. It's pretty easy to tell, like, okay, you know, that's a AAA game. You know, they have kind of a very, very samey kind of flavor.
Yeah, it's like Apple TV.
Yeah, it wasn't really a concern of mine. I do think, though, that sometimes this stuff goes to, because it's like you mentioned what is it, the Black Girl Gamers, or there's one of these smaller consulting groups, and, like, people, not that I don't think they're always wrong, that there are some issues there, but they always take it to the nth degree. And
yes.
My thing is, like, you guys gotta understand, Sweet Baby Ink, no Sweet Baby Ink, AAA, these studios, that's what they want to do, that's the direction they want to go. And the question is not, are there game consultants that are going to help with it, but if they weren't there, would they do this anyways? And I don't think anyone has an answer that says no to that. But
again, yeah, I think it's an issue with just media literacy, you know, because, like, if you really think about it, if you think about the bones of game development, it isn't too dissimilar from the bones, the idea, the sort of concept of making a feature-length film. Obviously, like, the parts are a little bit different, the time frame is a lot of bit different, the pieces are a little bit different. It's not totally the same game, but the rules are about the same. And so you have, you know, just like a lot of there's a lot of background things going on, a lot of things happening in order to produce these games. And so in the same way that movie and TV will bring in consultancy firms to ensure that their characters are authentic, or the world makes sense, or the dialogue is right, games are going to do the same. You know, that's why games score well, because they had multiple different teams, specialists come in to chisel this rock into a beautiful sculpture. And it's always so sad to me that instead of critiquing the art for what it is, we're taking it down for what it isn't, or what we want it to be, but it's not. And I don't know, like, that's not what art is. Art wasn't made for you. It's made for people. And if we are people, then we should be able to just enjoy our art, and or not enjoy it, not, like, drag individual people because we don't enjoy the art, because it's not what we conceptualize in our mind. That's crazy. If that's the case, go make your own thing. Like, come on. Like,
it is a little crazy because you see, you know, some of these games, I swear, Ubisoft, even for Skull and Bones, it's like a mid-sized city. I swear to my people that work on that game. And it's like to drag just out like a few people, especially if they're, for the most part, private. I mean, there are some ethical concerns around that. I think in some cases, maybe it's like the head of it or they're very public. Okay, maybe you have an argument there. But sometimes it just feels like people are just looking for breadcrumbs or breadcrumbs or proof that, you know, this is the reason why the game went bad. And it, for some of them, it's like, no, look, it's Ubisoft. they want to feed you mush. They want to give you the pink sludge.
Exactly. It's not like, you know, this individual blue-haired, non-binary queer person on the, I don't know, QA team who, like, didn't test the game enough, and now there are, like, all these bugs, and now, you know, like, my ship just hits an invisible wall and sinks. Like, that's not it. It's probably because Ubisoft wanted this game to get out, and they were tired of waiting, so they said, here's your release date, make it happen. And team was maybe like, can we have like 6 more months? And Ubisoft was probably like, no. That's usually what happens. Like, speaking from experience as someone who works in media and experiencing these sort of like crunch scenarios, these sort of stressing of the systems, it's exactly that. Like, you would hope to have a little bit more time to do some things, but more often than not, it's like, no, we need to do this now. And if we had time, we could make it great. But no, everything needs to be now.
Yep. And often with these developers, it's like with, you know, these firms are all over the world. They're not just Western-centric Anglosphere companies. Like we just mentioned the Skull, which is a terrible game. Skull and Bones, which is like Ubisoft Singapore. It's like, I mean, they probably know a lot about Western culture because, like, American culture is disseminated everywhere. But to an extent, that's not their lens. It's kind of weird sometimes we always apply that lens to every game. It's like, well, because that may not always be the case. But I get that's a whole other conversation. And
true.
We only have 15 minutes left here. So I think I am curious to hear about this because this is just me getting on my little soapbox. This isn't necessarily helpful for the entire audience. But a part of my feeling with these outlets, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, because I've had this theory, I think part of the reason that they can get away with treating their employees so poorly is, I think, especially for these game websites like Kotaku, I think there is this unspoken rule that, you know, because I worked in conservative media, and it is this way in many ways. It's like, you get to work here, and you get to work in this political, ideological atmosphere you'll feel comfortable in. And not everyone gets to do this. And you're not just working, Levi. You're working for the movement, for the cause. And that's why we can get away with ripping you off. I remember one time I had interviewed for a social media gig with one of these companies. And this guy, he is the literal son of a billionaire. He was running this conservative Canadian news operation, which later got bought out. And this guy was crazy. And he went at quite length when I did this interview. He was telling me how proud he was that he could get away with paying people as little as possible. I remember one time I did a job with their outlet. I was like, well, I could do a little bit of work here and there. And I was like, okay, we'll pay you $15 an hour. Not realizing they actually meant Canadian dollars, not that they had made that particular picture. I was like, oh yeah, $7. Do you think that's the case to some degree? Does it feel like, because games journalism, it is not this way in health journalism. It's not even this way with like work and disability stories. There does feel like there's a very ideological hold on it. Like, if you're not part of the very progressive left, you don't accept all those kind of things, that you're not really welcome into it. I mean, the people, you know, Gene Park, of course, last year he got in trouble with some because he wanted to talk to people like Eric Kane or Colin Moriarty. Colin Moriarty, of course, he could talk about. Not that all cases of bias are true, obviously, or that there are other reasons. But do you think that some extent, and then why do you think that is? Do you think that could ever change, or do you feel like games journalism, the culture is going to be kind of a left-wing culture where it is? Which is a lot, it's a kind of a pressury question, but I've tried to break into games journalism now and then, putting my tepid foot in, and I've had interesting experiences, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on all this. And so it's okay if you want to take a pass.
No, I'll take it. It just might be like a milk toasty kind of answer. Maybe it'll come off a little centrist. I don't consider myself a centrist. I think I'm very left-leaning, very progressive. I think I'm also just very understanding, and I'm very human. And I realize that even though I may be black and you may be white, if I rip my skin off, you're red, I'm red, we both have bones, we're both going to die. And so it's all, you know, our brains might be different. We might disagree politically, but I think having that shared humanity allows me to be more willing to meet some people in the middle than others are willing. And so I think that's more of the problem. We treat politics like sports. And, you know, and maybe that might be like very cliche to say. Maybe politicians have been saying that forever. Political pundits, political critics probably have said that. But I don't know if we truly think about that intimately, because I think that that's true. We choose a side, and in choosing a side, it's I'm right, you're wrong. My team's going to win, your team's not. I'm going to go to the Super Bowl, you're not. Like, it's not even a potential. There's not even a possibility to see the potential in the other team. Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to up and become a conservative. I don't agree with those values at all. Like, that's not my lifestyle. But I'm also not going to be like, well, all conservatives should die. Like, I'm not insane, I guess. And that sounds insensitive to say, but I just wish that there was a bit more empathy. I think we as people, not even just journalism, but just people, lack empathy. And that ends up bleeding into journalism, because a lot of leftists do become journalists because they want to change the world. They want to influence the world. They want to push the world into, you know, more inclusive, more welcoming lifestyles. And I agree with that. But I think to do that, we have to be willing to meet people in the middle. We have to... Shit. Some people deserve a second chance, I guess, you know? And I think if you're willing to hear people out and argue in good faith, then there's a chance that you would change a mind. It's not always going to happen. Some people are too far gone. And if those people are too far gone, then they're too far gone. And there's no reason to waste your energy on that. But not everyone is that, you know? So, yeah, I just feel like we as journalists, and, you know, I definitely try to enact this in my own life as well, in my work, too. We need to be more understanding of the variety of people that exist on this planet. Not to, you know, infantilize or put them on a pedestal or idolize or anything like that. Just to sort of come to a consensus that we could be equals in some way. So I think, could it change? Maybe. Will it? I think for as long as we're hyper-politicized, and for as long as we treat politics as sports, probably not.
You are, you're sadly probably correct, and I agree. Part of it is maturing and learning. I'm much less political in those senses. I've just become disenfranchised, and I'm like you. I kind of more like, I just care about more about the people and politics. Everything is separate. I don't know if we might be different politically, but it sounds like we had very similar backgrounds. I came from a single parent household, and I was raised a lot by my grandparents. And I mean, age 14 to 29, I was helping to raise my siblings. So and that's the great thing about games. That's, you know, they can cut across so many different demographics and lifestyles and people. And it's really quite a beautiful thing. And that's why I think games journalism, which can break into that, is so special.
I agree.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to come on the show, especially in the middle of this heated discourse. It's hard for people of different views to talk. You're willing to do this, and I really do appreciate that, Levi. I guess one last, I want to ask you two last things and we'll get out of here.
Yeah.
Do you think Kotaku has much of a future? What do you think is the future of the industry? Because it is kind of grim. Now, I don't want to say,
It is grim.
I'm not rooting for anyone to fail. People get mad at me this. Like, Kotaku's horrible. Well, don't you want them to all, you know, don't you want to collapse, everyone be out of job? I'm like, no, that's not how it works. They honestly think, most people think this. The outlets I like, they do good journalism. It's more objective. The outlets I don't like aren't. So when the outlets I don't like do the bad journalism, they go out of business, that tells all the other news companies, we better do good journalism or else we'll be out of a job. That is not what happens.
Yeah. It's not fair either. Like, to call for someone to lose their whole job, like to lose their house, to go homeless. Like, I'm not out here. Amazon sucks. You know, Amazon sucks. But I'm not out here hoping for every Amazon employee to, like, lose their income or something like that. Like, I'm not wanting, you know, Elon Musk is trash, but I'm not wanting Twitter employees to die. Like, that's crazy to me. So, okay, so going back, does Kotaku have a future? Always. I think Kotaku will always be around, no matter what. Unless, I don't know, there was a report, I think maybe last year, that Bobby Kotick, formerly Activision Blizzard, wanted to buy Kotaku. Unless something like that happens in some ninth circle of hell, Kotaku ain't going anywhere.
Whether
people love it or hate it, I think it's too culturally relevant, too, at least in the gaming culture, it's too culturally relevant to just up and die. So Kotaku will be here.
That would be such a Faustian bargain. That'd be such a monkey's paw. You're like, Activision, I know, right? Must, like, survive, and then the fire is Bobby Kotick.
It would be horrible. Like, I'm trying to imagine what would we even write about, and what, Activision Blizzard press releases, I guess. I don't know. What are we, the next season of Call of Duty Mobile? Like, what are we?
8 reasons why Activision microtransactions are awesome.
Exactly.
We need more of them.
This quarter, or Q2 2024, Activision posted $6.2 billion. That's like the headline or something. And it's just like a fluff piece. We do an interview with Bobby Kotick. It would be crazy. So unless something like that literally happens, Kotaku isn't going anywhere. The state of games journalism, though, I'm not too sure about this one. You know, I really do. And I think that that's just journalism writ large. Like, I think,
yeah,
it's a bad time to be in media right now. Honey, it is bad. And obviously, being games journalist, despite games journalism being, or video games, I should say, being the most profitable medium on the planet right now, games journalists don't make a lot of money because, for some strange reason, CEOs, venture capitalists, private equity firms are finding the wrong value in games journalism. They're trying to cater to the wrong things. And so they're bleeding, you know, these sites, these journalists, these ad streams dry. And it's creating issues all around. So will games journalism survive? I don't even know if journalism is going to survive. That girl's hanging on by a thread.
Yeah, that we could definitely swallow some black pills on that. I think some hope I've seen is, of course, like Aftermath, which is,
yes,
some of your former coworkers, which, by the way, they are doing great work. And, like, some of the people there were, like, the troublemakers, the ones I didn't really like all that much. But I admit, they are doing great work. Like, they did the Inside Baseball Week 2 weeks
which was
ago.
Great.
It was excellent. It was truly excellent. Really high quality work.
And see, I think that's what you get when you remove corporate interests from journalism. You get honesty. Like, you just get good work. You don't get, and I don't know if I can cuss, I already have a few times, but you don't get bullshit. And I'm not saying we produce bullshit. I just think that if we were allowed to do what makes us great, then you would get the great Kotaku work that you that you would expect from us. We do good work. We could be doing great work. And so when you remove that corporate interest and you have reader-funded publications, your discourse blog, your Hellgate, your Aftermath, your 404, hell, 404 Media, they're killing it right now. All of these reader-funded, worker-owned journalistic outfits are crushing. So I don't know. Is that the future? It's nice, but it definitely fractures the media landscape and makes it impossible for new folks to come in and folks who don't have large followings, like myself, survive if everything goes down. So I think it's a nice supplement, but I don't know if that's the future that I would want.
Yeah, well put. Okay, final question. You did an article for Kotaku recently. You've talked about breaking a controller playing Kingdom Hearts 1, the first on Fighting Sephiroth.
Yes.
Is that a true story? Did you really
yeah.
destroy the controller?
Yeah, this is a true story. I was out with, and the way that I opened it is also true. I was out with friends recently. We were drinking. We were sort of talking about video games, kind of like the state of state of media, you know, writing, creative pursuits and things like that. And as we're talking about video games and games as art, one of the friends asked, you know, some video games have been making me very mad lately. And he brought up Sekiro, Shadows Die Twice, the cleric beast, the demon of hatred. Brought up the demon of hatred boss. And, that boss sucks. He said, that boss made me, like, really grip my controller. Are there any games that, like, have made y'all mad or upset? And, you know, we're kind of going around and we're listing some games. And I was like, none of this compares to Sephiroth. Like, that in Kingdom Hearts 1, that boss, that platinum match sucks. And I've, even now when I think about it, it makes me so angry because I was so close to beating him. He had 10% health. He was so close. I just had to hit him one, maybe two more times. And he had these floating rocks that were like circling him and I couldn't dodge them quick enough. So as I'm like inching in, but I think I'm going to hit him, I mash the attack, it doesn't work, he kills me, and I just break the controller. I just break the controller. My grandma comes in, she's like, what's wrong? I'm like, nothing, grandma. Nothing, just video games. And she looks down and she's like, well, I heard a loud snap. What was that? And she looks down and she's like, oh, you know, you broke your controller. Well, you're going to have to buy a new one. I was like, yeah, okay, grandma.
He's like, well, you need to understand, there's this company called Mad Catz, and they produce junk.
Yeah, and thank God it was a Mad Catz, because, you know, I had a couple of the DualShock 2s, but I was getting so mad at the start of the match with him that I had to unplug my DualShock 2 and plug in my Mad Catz, because I knew that this was going to be, like, a sweat-inducing moment. And, well, I can't say it was sweat inducing, but it was definitely controller breaking.
Dude, yeah, so many of those KH1 that does have some of that design in it, where like just the secret or extra bosses are just ridiculous. They're so ridiculous. I don't even think the other games, which they have some ridiculous fights in them, but that is rage and design. I think the original Sonic Adventure for me on Dreamcast.
Sonic Adventure is a good game.
Yeah, to this day, for whatever reason, I can't seem to complete that chaos fight. I beat it one time, and then my brother, in a fit of jealousy, he erased the save. And he did it right there in front of me, too, so I could see it. I just lost it. And I've never been able to beat it since.
No. Oh, that is so terrible. Oh, I feel for you.
I know.
Video games, you love them and you hate them. What a terrible story. I've had things happen like that to me too. Not like my brother erasing them, because my brother's much older than me. He didn't play games like that. But just like friends, you know, family, cousins, nephews by accident. A lot of controller throwing in my days. A lot of like disc snapping. Definitely snapped a few discs here and there. Video games.
Some of them probably deserved it, though.
Some of them did, I'll be honest. Yeah, you know, Final Fantasy 13, this one time, I was pretty close to beating it, and it told me to switch to disc 3. And so, you know, it had auto-saved and told me to switch to disc 3. And so I was like, okay, let me switch to disc 3, put disc 3 in, and it loads up, but then it loads back to the main menu for some reason, and it's like, continue, and I hit continue, and it's like, save corrupted. I was like, oh, wow, are you serious? So yeah, that one.
That whole generation was cursed, Red Ring of Death.
Yeah, that whole Xbox 360 era was very frustrating.
Yeah, very janky.
Just a lot of moments like that. Love video games, but wow, do they make me angry sometimes.
Well, this is fun. Thank you so much, Levi. I appreciate it. Where can people find you, of course, at Kotaku? Any other place you'd like to plug for people to visit?
Yeah, I mean, you can
share?
Always read my stuff at kotaku.com, or, you know, I tweet occasionally. I tend to just tweet out what I write. XOLSLOW, that's XELLESLOW. That's Twitter, and I think that's probably the same on Instagram. I try to keep my handles, you know, pretty unanimous or pretty equal across the board. Levi Winslow, Kotaku.com, that's where you can find me most.
Awesome. Well, people, go check him out. He writes some good stuff. I really enjoyed reading his stuff, getting ready for this. He's a fine writer. And you said you were witty. I know they do say that brevity is the essence of wit, but I mean, I think you're plenty witty. You're a fine writer.
Oh, thank you so much. And by the way, that's they pronouns. They, them.
They, them. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, well, we're going to end it here, guys. Thank you so much for taking the time to watch CultureScape today. Thank you to my editor, Chris Holowicki, who makes me look way more competent than I actually am. To my good friends at Young Voices, a journalism advocacy organization, of course, Bain Books, and Imprint Simon Schuster, thank you for helping put together the show. It's much appreciated. And lastly, to all of you fine watchers and listeners, you are the reason I keep coming back to do this. And so again, until next time, friends, keep geeking out.